The Packers will play the Patriots in Green Bay. Taking a look at our weather, we can expect sunny skies for today. The highs will be in the low to mid-60s. For tonight, mostly clear skies, lows in the mid-50s. For tomorrow, it'll be sunny, highs near 65. For Saturday night, mostly clear skies, lows around 54. And on Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 63. This is WGTD News, and remember, Wisconsin Public Radio's fall membership drive is underway. Contribute online at WPR.org or call 1-888-202-2552.
And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's Morning Show interview was initially broadcast back in 2020. It's not all that often on the Morning Show that we get to talk about television or that we get to explore in depth a wonderful show like Modern Family. This great program has just gone off the air. After more than a decade of distinguished excellence and many, many Emmy Awards, all very much deserved. We're going to be talking today about a really fascinating book that takes a probing look behind the scenes of this a modern phenomenon. And I'm very, very excited to be able to speak with Mark Freeman, who has written for Vanity Fair, The Hollywood Reporter, and Slate, and has written a number of different oral histories on shows ranging from MASH to Cheers to the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. And his latest book is titled Modern Family, The Untold Oral History of One of Television's Groundbreaking Sitcoms. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. Mark Freeman, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Well, with an introduction like that, I'm more than welcome to be here.
Well, I really loved your book. I mean, I love Modern Family, but it seems to me that even someone who, for whatever reason, is not a huge fan of this show would still find your book interesting because it really helps us understand how a television program, and especially a kind of complicated television program, gets put together. I think you would probably agree, although it probably is also true that it helps if someone really loves this program as much as you and I do.
Yeah, so the intent was exactly what you just said, which was to make it accessible to fans and non-fans alike. Obviously, if you're a fan of the show, you're going to get more out of a book because you'll recognize all the little details from episodes or references that people make. But going into it, I wanted to also, if I was going to elevate from article form to book form with the oral history, I wanted to open up to a broader audience of people who I'd be talking to make the project, and I ended up talking to like 100 or so people. But then B, I wanted to give people a little insight into television production, how a series is made, what goes into it from coming up with the idea to even deciding to end an idea, in this case ending a series. So I wanted to give people a backstage pass, and one of the things I've been happy to hear so far is that people who don't know the show, who may have been forced to read the book, but but they really liked it and wanted to actually watch the show during quarantine, do a nice binge watching, because it's accessible to them so that if they don't know the characters, they know them by the end of the book, and they want to see what the book talks about, be it within episodes, characters, plot lines, however it is. It's just one of those, if you're into pop culture and you're into television in general, there's something there for you that doesn't have to be for just a Modern Family fan.
Right. If you would, take us behind the scenes of the making of this book. That is, who pitches a project like this to whom? I mean, you were ultimately granted what seems like almost across-the-board access to just about every major player, both on-screen and off-screen, who's been part of Modern Family. But how does such a thing happen? I mean, Well, let me just restate that question. Who pitched what to whom?
I was the pitcher, and generally I was looking to go. One of the things that I find with oral histories in general when I write them is I always end up cutting great stories, because at some point you have to cut, right? And with an article, you get a word count, and there's flexibility within it, but you're still kind of mandated more by a word count than by the content of a story. And if a story is really good, you want to have the liberty and freedom to follow that story however long it takes. So I had decided that I wanted to try a book instead of an article. And Modern Family lent itself very well to me because I only want to do shows that I know, meaning I'm a fan and I've watched almost every episode of whatever series, which is why I've chosen some of the episodes, the series you had mentioned, like MASH and Cheers and the Bob Newhart Show. I knew these shows inside and out, so that's criteria one. Two is, am I connected at all with people I've talked to a show? And in this case, some of the people from Modern Family, the co-creator, the casting director, they were from Frasier. I knew them from Frasier, having done an oral history article for Vanity Fair about Frasier, and really loved the people, got along great with them. And so I thought, you know, this is kind of interesting because it's an easy segue into another series, but it's not just a traditional oral series where you look back at the history. It's something where you can actually capture lightning in a bottle of the moment itself. You get to be there, and wouldn't it be cool to not just do oral history past, but oral history present? And when I started writing the book, they had just started the last year, so it was also oral history future. So I got to do the complete bookends, but it also, there's a currency to it, so it's not just, hey, remember back when this series started and Obama was president, and it's today. It carried everything up. In fact, the last episode, the last thing that was shot was about a week before the whole pandemic thing became big, big news. It was at the end of February, and if it had gone into March, they probably would not have been able to finish shooting it because the set would have been closed down.
Wow. A close call for sure.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that our listeners who have not yet seen your book understand its format. And one of my questions was going to be whether or not there's a fancy term for this kind of format. And I think maybe the term might be oral history. But explain to our listeners, if they open up your book, what they're going to see in terms of how this book is laid out. It's a format that I happen to really, really love, and I've enjoyed it in other books about great television programs. Explain what this book looks like, and if this is a good example of what you've referred to already in this interview as an oral history.
So an oral history is, and what I love about it is, it's not the author interpreting. There are moments where the author can, you're setting up and you're transitioning and you're filling in, but it's really history as told by the people who are there. So instead of writing the biography of George Washington, you're actually sitting next to George Washington, and you're eating off the cherry tree there, you are talking about why they did things, their motivations behind it, their memories of it. And what's kind of cool about it is, and this will almost sound lazy in a sense, but it's forgiving history because it's somebody's memory. And your memory of a particular incident of your childhood might not be 100% accurate, but it's how you remember it, and so people can't question it. And so within an oral history, people are giving their memories and their insight and maybe even a reinterpretation of something as they're reflecting back. And so when you open a book, my intent, and I discovered this early on, and I just kind of really enjoyed the format, was I'm going to interview a lot of people, but I don't want it to feel disjointed, where one person's talking about mayonnaise, and then the next person's talking about Cheerios, and then the next person's talking about their favorite color. I wanted it to feel like everybody is in the same room in a roundtable discussion or on stage, and they're all talking about this same thing. And so when you open the book, what you'll see is on any given page 10, 20 quotes, and they're cited. Usually it's the who's ever speaking, who they are, like the name of their character or the director or co-creator, and their quote. And then that will immediately be followed by another quote. And in certain instances, I would take a quote. If you said something, I could take it to person B, and I'd say, you know, Greg said this thing. And then they would respond. And then I could go back to you, and I'd say, you know what they said about your thing. Or I could go to a third person. I'd say, you know what, these two people, they were talking about this, that, or the other thing. And so you then, almost like a puzzle piece, and someone had said that analogy to me, which I think is a really good one, you're then putting a puzzle together of all these quotes, of all these people talking about stuff, and you're organizing this conversation. And it can be about, the chapter can be about an episode, and then you're putting together into one big bucket everyone talking about the episode, and you're going to organize how they talk about the episode and what they talk about within the episode. And you might even return to them as you're writing the chapter because you realize there's a gap there, or this person didn't answer that question for this chapter, so they're not there. So you're piecing together the history in a way that for the reader, whether they recognize the episode or the show or whatever it is, they can still participate and get something out of it because they're kind of a fly on the wall of a conversation about something interesting, be it Modern Family or be it television production, which is another theme of this book in general. How is a TV show made? And, you know, no show is ever going to be perfect. There's going to be struggles involved. And listening in on that and how people created iconic moments or an iconic series or so on, I'm all about the art of creation and how that comes to be in whatever form, be it the writer's, be it the actor's interpretation of something, be it a director deciding to put a camera in a certain place. I just love to explore that and then to share what those people remember with an audience.
Hmm. By the way, as you kind of explain the construction of the book, it reminds me of the first time, at the risk of mentioning someone else's book, but I remember the first time I read a book in this format, which was some years ago, and it's a very, very well-known oral history of Saturday Night Live. And I remember loving that book, but I also remember thinking, boy, this is also, I am jealous of the author. I mean, what an easy thing to do. I mean, because just at a glance, it seemed like a much easier way to write a book than to write the kind of more standard nonfiction prosaic account of something or another. You're just putting a bunch of quotes together from all these other people. It's like they did the work for you. And I mean, the more you think about it, the more you realize how ridiculous that assumption is. But I think you did a really good job of helping explain how this is every bit as complicated, in some ways probably more complicated, in terms of a way to put together a comprehensive examination of a show like Modern Family. You have all these quotes, but then you have to put them in order and make sense of all of them. That's no small task.
Yeah, I mean, you are trying to take, you're in a cafeteria and you're listening to a million conversations and you're trying to make something cohesive out of that. I've noticed in reviews of the book that Saturday Night Live book has been the one it's been compared to the most for the format of kind of what you said. I think in some ways, as a writer, it can be easier because somebody's saying the words, and so you're not writing, interpreting as much. The flip side being the interviews you do, the transcriptions, you are paying attention to every word because it's coming from them. So if you mess up a word here or there, it's different when you're paraphrasing in an interpretive book, be it fiction or nonfiction. But you are taking something and you are putting it in your processor and then spitting it out. Whereas if you're taking someone else's words, at least for me, I feel an obligation to be accurate down to the commas if need be, and at times I'll collaborate with the people who are speaking, and I'll go back to them with a quote and I'll say, you know, this is what you said, I'm not sure exactly what you meant by this. Could you clarify? Or do you, when you say this kind of thing, it's going to stand out for this, that, or the other reason. Are you comfortable with that? And they'll say yes or no. And it's really not about gotcha moments. You're not trying, at least for me, again, you're not trying to embarrass people. I don't want to write a gossip book that's just full of smut of who didn't like who and who flirted with who and what drugs did this or that person take, none of which relates to this particular show, by the way. But I just really want to look and explore, like I was saying, the art of creation and how people put something together. In this case, it's a TV series. But there's so much that goes into that, and choices that are made for characters or dialogue or plot or locations to shoot or happy accidents that become iconic moments to a series. It's just so rich with ideas, and it doesn't have to be brought down to the lowest common denominator of what I was talking about before, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It doesn't have to be that, but you can still have all the behind-the-scenes stories and backstage passes to enjoy.
Right. And I suppose a case could be made that many programs would be interesting if you take them apart, even shows that are not as groundbreaking or as successful over as long a period of time as Modern Family. But it sure helps when the show is this interesting and this successful. And I think you've put together a great book. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Mark Freeman. His new book is called Modern Family, The Untold Oral History of One of Television's Groundbreaking Sitcoms. The book explores the way in which Modern Family was constructed at the outset and executed with such excellence over the course of more than a decade. Mark Freeman, I really appreciate the context with which you help set the stage for the creation of this show. And in the chapter called First Days, you help us understand all of the different choices and possibilities that were at play before the co-creators of this show, Christopher Lloyd and Stephen Levitin, finally settled on what the concept would be. Explain to our listeners just a little bit about what I'm talking about, how there were all kinds of balls in the air before finally the central concept was eventually solidified.
Well, this goes back to that redundant thing I keep saying about the art of creation, but Steve and Chris were both established TV showrunners who had come together because at the time of the show, around 2007, 2008, 2009, there was a television strike, so a lot of writers were out of work. There had been a lot less sitcoms being made at the time, so there was just this dearth that they were trying to fill. And they had come together because of that, the fact that they thought maybe the two of us, being powerful people, could make ideas, push ideas through. And they did a series called Back to You on Fox, which ended up being a disaster more because of the dealings with the Fox network than the show itself. But they owed one more series, and they were trying to come up with ideas, and they would get together every day on the Fox lot, and they would spitball ideas. And in between that, intermittently, they would talk about things that had happened at home the night before, the weekend, with wife, children, relatives, extended family. And they found those were the funniest and most interesting stories they were coming up with. And so they thought to themselves, there isn't really any family show right now, so there's nothing that's reflecting this. And there's nothing that's really capturing, in a way that Seinfeld captures a show about nothing, there's nothing really capturing the essence of the nuances of family. And wouldn't it be cool if we could maybe put that together in some form? And so once they hit on that and they knew the kind of stories they wanted to tell, which would be taken from their lives and ultimately the writers' lives, it was an idea of how do we share that with an audience? We know we want more than one family. We don't just want that core nuclear family that you get on a lot of TV shows. But then what form should this take? And so they knew they wanted multiple families, comedy has the rule of three, so they landed on three families eventually. And if you ever know with a joke, the fourth beat of a joke is death. So comedy rule of three does really work well. So they knew they wanted three families, but then it was a question of how do we establish these families? They thought about a cul-de-sac where three families live in houses in the cul-de-sac, and maybe something happens like a first day of school or chicken pox or a passing of a relative, and each family experiences that in the cul-de-sac, and you tell the story that way. And they ultimately decided they felt a little disjointed, maybe a little forced, and they in turn eventually landed on siblings. And they thought, we'll have three siblings, and they'll be... one will be gay, which is what ended up happening. One will be the daughter, and then they'll have a third sibling, which they had thought about maybe as a divorced sibling. But they were all working on the same generation. And then somewhere along the line, Steve Levitan talked to a friend of his who threw in the idea of a patriarch, of a dad, a different generation. And then it all started to make sense that this doesn't have to be three siblings. It can be an extended family that the umbrella could be the patriarch himself, but it's not one of those shows like Dallas, like a soap opera about it. It's just a multi-generational show of family, which anybody and everybody can relate to. And from there, they just worked out the more nuances of detail.
Hmm. It seems like a perfect example of the good things that at least can happen, that don't probably always happen, but can happen when you just think about something a little harder. And instead of just going with kind of the knee-jerk, oh, let's make a show about this, with kind of tired formulas that have been done, you know, countless times before, with maybe just the smallest little variations, you know, let's make a radio station instead of a TV station, or, you know, whatever the variation might be on something else that's already tried and true. They took the time to think about other possibilities beyond the obvious. And, of course, what they ultimately landed on was something that was just incredibly rich in terms of the possibilities that it offered up.
And also it was for its time, and things always move in waves. It was very different for its time. It was a family show in what the creators like to refer to as an era of snark, that the brilliance of comedy that makes you uncomfortable, like The Office, Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is still around, Seinfeld, you get these uncomfortable situations and the characters can sarcastically react to them. And it was a form of comedy, very funny form, but it was a form of comedy that everyone and their mother was then doing. This is what sells, and this is what you find in TV and movies all the time. This works. Let's do this, except we'll change the character's name and put it in a different, you know, city. And it always takes that one person or that group of people who say, you know what? What if we did this? We're putting ourselves out on the ledge here. This might fail. But nobody's doing this thing, and it's something we can really explore. And the rule of writing, they always tell you, is write what you know. And they knew family. They had family. There hadn't really been a successful family show since the end of Everyone Loves Raymond. There was only really one or two shows on at the time, and those were the typical videotaped in front of a live audience with a lot of canned laughter kind of shows. It wasn't ones about the subtlety of family that could have heart, which was the other thing that really went against the grain of snarkiness. It's the kryptonite to snark is heart. And they thought, what if we did a family show and that at the end there could be some kind of warmth or heart to this reality that people can relate to in everyday life of family.
Hmm. I wonder if you could tell our listeners about the incredibly dramatic moment that occurred in the pilot pitch. So this is before the pilot episode has even been made. This is just that event or situation or setting in which the premise for a pilot is being pitched to people who might either say nope, no thank you, or yes, go ahead, make this pilot for us. And I should think that in most cases, nothing all that exciting or dramatic happens in pitch sessions, but there was an incredibly exciting moment in this one, and it was a stroke of brilliance. Tell our listeners what I'm talking about.
I believe what you're talking about is the computer itself, which is that at the time, you know, laptops were definitely around and being used, but people weren't using them in pitches. And so when they pitched the idea to the executives, they were, in this case, Steve Levitan, one of the co-creators, was explaining a particular incident which had taken place in his life, which is that his son had gotten a BB gun and had been warned very explicitly, you don't aim it at people, and if you shoot anybody, you know, you in turn will get punished or shot yourself. And that's exactly what had happened. He had inadvertently shot his sister, and so the punishment was he was going to get shot. I know it sounds like child abuse. It was not child abuse. It was more of a comedic moment. And you would understand the danger of guns in general and not to play around with them. And Steve had filmed that. It had become a funny little family thing, and he had filmed it happening. And so when they were pitching potential ideas to the executive saying, oh, it would be stories like this, that, and the other thing, when he got to the other thing and he was telling that particular story, he realized on the computer that they were using for the presentation, he actually had the footage itself of the moment. And so rather than create the moment and try to describe it, why not show it? And so the second that the executive saw that, it was over. They're like, I have to have this show. And so it was the unplanned, perfect audition that captured better than anybody could in shooting something phony what they were going to be striving to get with their show.
You know, I'd forgotten all about that. That's another amazing part of the pitch. What I was actually thinking of in my question was the matter of them realizing, oh my gosh, these three different families are all part of the same family, which
that was a brilliant thing that they. So one of the things was that they used this particular app where they would take people through, and Steve ended up showing me the actual more or less PowerPoint slide presentation of what they did, and so that rather than a pitch being, it's going to be about this former baseball player, and he works in a bar, and these people come into the bar, and they talk about their lives like people in a bar do. They set it up as, here's family A, and this is what their life is. It's a older man with a younger wife who he married as a second marriage, and she has a son who's kind of this romanticist in a world of people his age who aren't romanticists. And in this particular episode pilot, this is going to happen. And then you meet another family, and then you meet another family. But the selling point at the end of the pitch was with a picture of a family tree, that you suddenly come to the realization that all these families are part of the same family, the same extended family. And when they set up the pitch that way, the big reveal that they were all part of the same family blew away the executives when they saw it and were presented with it. And if you watch the pilot and you don't know that going in, it blows you away too, because you're seeing what you think are three separate families going through these things, but they all come together at the end to rally, in this case, around Mitch and Cam bringing their Vietnamese daughter that they've adopted to show to the rest of the family. And so they gather for a family event, and then it's one of those major aha moments, which was a major selling point for the series, too, that you start rethinking everything that's happened and everything that everybody said and everything they did and how it built towards this, and it makes perfect sense they're all together, because they all talk about being together and they talk about each other, but you don't really realize they're talking about each other as in the other family that's on the show.
Just incredible. And I so appreciate that that we're in a sense taken into that room to experience that thrilling moment, which Christopher Lloyd calls the clincher moment when it all comes together. And, of course, a very enthusiastic green light is given. We're speaking with Mark Freeman about his book Modern Family, The Untold Oral History of One of Television's Groundbreaking Sitcoms. This is probably a good time to also mention, especially for the sake of somebody who has not seen the show, although I suspect most of our listeners have seen it, that the show is actually set up, in a sense, as though somebody was making a documentary about this modern family. And there are these certain points where one or two characters will be sitting on the couch and talking straight to the camera as though they're answering a question about something or other. And the way this was framed in the pitch is different from the way that it actually ended up being executed in the pilot and in all of the episodes that followed thereafter. And I think that the conversations behind the scenes about how this element should be handled is also really important indication of the care with which they were shaping this project. Can you talk a moment about that?
Yeah, so, you know, this mockumentary style, which really started with the British version of The Office, and I got a chance, and he's in the book, to talk to Stephen Merchant, who created the British version with Ricky Gervais. It's a style, but it doesn't necessarily, and this is where the mock part comes in, it doesn't have to be, it's a takeoff on the documentary style, but it doesn't have to be a documentary itself. And when they started the series, and they were thinking at the head and tail of this, we'll base it around a documentary filmmaker. In this case, he's Dutch, and he was an exchange student, and he stayed with Phil and Claire and the Dunphy family growing up, and he spent a year there. And they were what he called My American Family, and he was going to be shooting a documentary about My American Family. And at the head and tail of every episode, you would see him, and he'd probably set up what the episode was going to be about, and then he'd wrap it up in a pretty bow at the end. And what they discovered in putting it together was this was going to become an obstacle, really. It was going to be something that you had to cater towards in every episode, and that would in time feel forced. And that if they really just removed that aspect of it, the head and tail documentary filmmaker, yet stuck with the style, that would be okay, that people would accept that, which they do in like Parks and Rec, and they do in The Office, although at the very end The Office did show in one little scene there was a documentary crew. But the idea was shoot it like that documentary, but at the same time, because this is in a family realm, you can't really make it a documentary, because if it was one, what does it say about the characters? I mean, if someone's letting in, if you're a parent and you're letting some cameras follow your kids everywhere except the bathroom, and you let your child grow up on television, what does that say about you as a parent? And if you're allowing these intimate moments to be shared to the world, what does that say with you as a person? Do you not care about privacy? Are you all about being a social media star? And they thought that the audience wouldn't like these people as much if it was that true documentary, and that it was okay to use the style, and that's really what it is in the end. It's a style of shooting in which the camera has the freedom to move and be, in a sense, sloppy like you can find in a documentary. You don't have to have the perfect frame. You can quickly zoom left or right, follow the action as if something happens, and quickly, let's get over there. You can use the nuances of that style, but you don't have to be a true documentary itself. And Parks and Rec started right before them, and The Office was already established, so the mockumentary style had taken hold in American television. It just hadn't been done on the family level, and you couldn't really make it a true documentary, as I was saying, on the family level without running into the obstacles of what I was just talking about.
Right. I think and again, it's such an indication of the care with which they were thinking about this family and the individual characters who were part of it and their relationship and how we as viewers would likely relate to them. I mean, they really, I think, showed their smarts and their sensitivity in the way that they made some of these choices. And also, that's very evident in the chapter Family Portrait, in which you talk about some of the nuances with which they shaped some of these characters and their relationships. We could talk about a whole bunch of them, but I think we should just talk about two of them. One of them is the couple of Jay and Gloria. So Jay is the dad of two other characters who are part of the other two families. But Jay is with a new wife, a second wife, a much younger wife, really beautiful wife. And there are ways in which a relationship like this could really be a little icky at a glance. And it's not, because of the way it was cast and the way these two characters are shaped and written. Talk for a moment about the way in which this particular couple was put together and why it works so well.
So it was funny in talking to the creators that in the original form of it, that Jay, the male character, the husband, he was in the midst of getting a divorce, and at his divorce party, there's a bikini bartender there that was going to be this Gloria character. That was the original iteration, which I'm very glad they didn't go that way. I mean, there's a whole litany of things you could write about that would have made that a poor choice. But what they looked at was, okay, from Jay's perspective, you get a second chance on life. This is going to be, in a sense, your reward for having had a difficult marriage. You're now going to get to celebrate a second chance and learn your lessons. The problem with that is that she comes with a child you just don't understand because you're very traditional, sports-oriented, slap-on-the-back kind of dad, and now you have this child, this romanticist, kind of like a Cyrano kind of character, and you don't know how to relate to him. Meanwhile, your children from your first marriage are looking at you in this second marriage, seeing you act all these ways that you didn't in the first marriage, the way that you're trying to get along with the kid and understand him, the way that you're working with your wife to work through issues or to coexist. And so there's these elements of jealousy in the way that they were raised. The flip side being, and Ed O'Neill and Sofia Vergara had talked about this, was you had this Gloria character who was very, very, very all about family. Anything to protect her family, to help her family. And so she had had this whole career of jobs is what they decided for her. Anything to keep, you know, food, to have food for Manny and a roof over his head. And so that when she married Jay, it was probably more because she thought he was a nice guy who could provide a safe life for Manny and a good life for me, but not as some kind of exploitive spender diva, but just someone who could give a nice, safe life to my family, and that in time they fell in love. And so the whole stereotype of, oh, he's just lusting after a young woman, you add all these layers to it and all the complications that come with it, and it's no longer that typical scenario of old man, young, hot woman kind of story that Hollywood in general, in movie and TV, gravitate towards way too often.
Absolutely.
It suddenly has layers and complexities to it.
Absolutely. It's such a good choice. And they made some very good choices indeed when it came to the couple of Cam and Mitchell. And of course, it's noteworthy that we have two men who eventually are married and who are raising a daughter, and it's they were breaking ground on all kinds of different levels. But you tell us through the words of one of the executive producers of the show, Bill Rubel, that a really important choice made early on was in making Cam and Mitch homebodies. Simple, normal people at home with a baby. He says that they're doing simple things like trying to figure out what to give their kid for breakfast or to give a good birthday party. That normalizes them as a couple. We realize there that that's one thing that sets them apart from, for instance, more kind of wildly flamboyant characters who had been seen on television before. Part of what made them remarkable was how normal they were, in a sense. I mean, normal people who just happened to be gay. I don't think I'd stop to think about that till I read your book.
And it is a very interesting point, and I think ultimately the people who talk about it in the book will say it a lot more elegantly than me, but they kind of thought, who's going to be, you're right in the sense of if they're the flamboyant characters, then they play into the stereotype. And to the families across America that maybe are more conservative, they won't be accepting of them. But if you took them and you take that level of their sexuality and you don't mean that as this defines them as people, it's an aspect of who they are, but it's really about the relationship and raising a family. If you take the universality of any relationship and you say, this is what this is like, and in this case, the normalcy of which you speak, then it is accessible. And people don't look at that aspect and don't put into it their own views of how they view the LGBTQ community or anything. It's no longer about that. It's about these two characters. And what the actors found in time was in talking to people, not just in the U.S., but across the world, that people were, in a sense, being introduced to the first gay people that they knew through these characters. And they enjoyed the characters, and suddenly they weren't viewing that community the same way. They were actually viewing them as they should be viewed, as just normal, everyday people like everybody. Hmm. We're all the same. And in that sense, it was acceptable. And so there was no lack of comfort for them. It was just something that was part of a family, and it wouldn't have worked any other way unless they were the most normal, mundane of the group in terms of the events that they went in that made their plot lines. And they were well aware of that, which is why they wanted to introduce it that way, get people to be invested in those characters, accept them, and then you can start to stretch the limitations of the things that they experience, and people will go along for the ride.
Right. I want to make sure people understand that we hear from every major cast member, as well as all of the major figures in putting this book together. And we're taken through all kinds of different topics, and it's an endlessly fascinating exploration. We spend a lot of time in the writer's room and with many of the writers. And in some cases, we are shown original moments in scripts and then the revised moment where something that was already pretty good becomes even better. There's also a really interesting chapter devoted to the women who have written for this show. And for the most part, it's been a struggle for them to fit in to this writer's room, which has been dominated by men. And we hear from them, and it's a fascinating moment as well. I do want to take a moment to say that in the midst of what is a really feel-good story with so many just really nice people who are wonderful to each other. I mean, this is a family not only on screen but off screen as well. But at the head of it all, the two men who co-created this, Christopher Lloyd and Stephen Levitin, ended up having what almost kind of amounts to a creative professional divorce. And they end up, in a sense, really separating from each other. We don't have a whole lot of time, but I wonder if you could just summarize for our listeners this uneasy relationship between the two of them that they were nevertheless able to make work.
So in broad strokes, most partnerships, people start when they're nobodies and they rise together and maybe eventually fall apart. In this instance, because of the way Hollywood was at the time, the dearth of sitcoms, you had two powerhouse showrunners come together under circumstances of the times to make something. And so they both have definitive versions of how you make a series of the stories you tell and how you tell them. And they actually were good friends coming into this, but once they started working together, it just didn't work because they both had their ideas of what they wanted an episode to be. And so a writer goes to Steve, and Steve gives them notes, and they make the corrections, and they go to Chris, and Chris says, oh, you should change this, this, and this. And they do, and then they go back to Steve, and Steve's like, these aren't my changes. And it created this friction, which didn't really carry over to the set as much as create problems in the writer's room. And what they ultimately landed on, because neither wanted to leave the series because it meant so much to them, was that they would do more or less every other episode. One of them would be in the writer's room, and the other one would be on set shooting, and then they would reverse the following week. And what's most fascinating about this underlying theme of this friction, which is one of the more interesting parts of the book in general, is that when you talk to both of them, and I didn't realize this till I interviewed them, they basically didn't watch the other's episodes. So you have, as Chris had said, if there was a trivia game, he would lose in the Modern Family trivia game because out of 250 episodes, he basically hadn't seen 125 of them. And the same thing for Steve. And so what you end up with is it's amazing that you create 250 seamless episodes that blend week to week between two showrunners who more or less shot a 125-episode series independent of one another. And the compromise they made in the end was that when Steve has an episode, they do the table read, and then they take their notes and they retreat to the writer's room, that at that moment, Chris could come in and give his feedback on the table read and the script, and then it was up to Steve whether he listened to it or not. And then the next week, the exact same thing would happen. So there was input, sometimes listened to and sometimes not, but it was really that one person's episode, which they then the other person never saw it filmed or watched it on TV.
Amazing. And, you know, when we watch the show, I mean, you do point out that there are certain elements that one of them would use a lot that the other would never use. And so if we really stop and think about it, we can probably discern that this is a Steve Levitin episode, this is a Christopher Lloyd episode. But to the average casual viewer, and even to a devoted viewer, it all feels like one show. There's a miraculous seamlessness, despite the fact that there is, in a sense, this fracture right at the top of what otherwise is an incredibly harmonious and lovely family. And we should mention also briefly that you spent a concentrated amount of time really watching an episode being filmed. It was, in a sense, a complicated episode. They kept apologizing that you were there in a rough week. But really, all that you saw was just how wonderful something like this can be when you have the right people working so beautifully together.
So in most television production, you are shooting multiple days for, it can be 12, 14 hours. And that's where I learned the term Fratterday, when you start on a Friday and it goes into Saturday morning. This show was unique in the sense that because they were using the mockumentary style and doing universal lighting, they could capture everything with two cameras in one take. So they didn't have to do close-ups and reset lighting and do all this. And so because of that, they could capture it all. As they used to say, it's 45 minutes for setup, 15 to shoot. They reversed it, and they could do 45 minutes of shooting and 15 of setup. So they were everybody. They were the envy of Hollywood in that they could finish things usually by lunchtime, by 2 to 3 in the afternoon. And because there were three families, no particular family had to be on set more than maybe 2 days a week. So imagine a two-day week when you work from 7 in the morning to 2 in the afternoon. I think a lot of people would take those hours. The flip side being, in the episodes I saw, and I ended up seeing three or four episodes being filmed, they were a little more complex, and they ended up shooting till 8 or 9 at night, still less than what a lot of shows did. And so the crew would always walk by, and I became very friendly with them, and they'd say, oh, my God, you picked the wrong week. It's crazy here. It's normally not like this. Meanwhile, I'm a kid in a candy store because I get to be on set for 12, 13 hours and watch the process and get to know the people, and I'm thrilled by it. But, yeah, every single time, every single episode, they would apologize, and I'm thinking either they're pulling my leg or they're being sincere about this, that it isn't normally like this. But I loved it. I just loved being on set and watching the whole process and this art of creation, everybody making a contribution from the most subtlest of subtleties of feeding people to building. I watched them build an airplane for one scene in the finale with Mitch and Cam sitting in an airplane, but they built the entire body of that plane over 2 days. The crew's that amazing to watch. They could build a village, you know, in a week.
Mark Freeman's book is Modern Family, The Untold Oral History of One of Television's Groundbreaking Sitcoms. This interview was recorded and initially